Welcome to Deep Macro's podcast on the future of finance. Today, our guest is Ishwar Prasad. He's the Tolani Senior Professor of Trade Policy and Professor of Economics at Cornell University. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he holds the New Century Chair in International Economics and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He was previously chief of the Financial Studies Division in the IMF's Research Department, and before that, he was the head of the IMF's China Division. So even though we're talking mostly about crypto, I'm probably going to try to slip something in about China too. Welcome, Ishwar.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me on.
Yes, and I did want to say a lot of what we're going to be talking about is in Ishwar's latest book, which I have right here. It's called The Future of Money: How the Digital Transformation or Revolution is Transforming Currencies and Finance. It came out last year, and it's really timely, extremely comprehensive, very readable. It also gets into the technology, which is something that trips up a lot of people. So I highly encourage everybody to go out and get that book. But anyway, let's start. And in the book, you make the point that crypto is digital. It really doesn't have a physical existence, unlike currency that we know. But one of the points of your book is that most money that we use today is already digital. So could you please explain what you mean by the whole thing about digitization of money?
It's true, Jeff, that most of the money that we deal with in our day-to-day transactions, especially if you happen to live in a country like China or Sweden, is already digital. Now, our bank balances are digital, and much of what we conduct transactions with is digital, although we still have paper currency in the form of dollar bills, yuan notes, and so on. Although these are, in my view, a dying breed. One of the key issues that we're seeing across the world is the increasing prevalence of digital payment systems, whether you're thinking about mobile phone-based technologies in a country like India, Alipay in Kenya and India, Alipay and WeChat Pay in China, or Swish in Sweden. So the question is whether central bank money is really going to have much traction at the retail level anymore. And that's a question that I think central banks are grappling with around the world. And there is a broader question here, whether it makes a difference at all, whether central banks continue to issue money that is relevant to the retail level, because most money creation in modern economies these days is by commercial banks when they create loans and in tandem create corresponding deposits. But central bank money does have an important role to play at the retail level in many countries, but also in terms of wholesale payments when banks settle balances between each other. So central bank money is going to remain relevant in different forms. But I think the reality is that the end of cash or physical currency as we know it is certainly drawing to an end.
So, okay, that's interesting. If we think about, you know, phones and other electronic payment systems you mentioned, versus crypto, what really is the new element then of crypto? From a transactional point of view, maybe?
What Bitcoin set out to achieve was something truly remarkable. Bitcoin, of course, is the original cryptocurrency. And as with anything else, timing is everything. And Bitcoin came on the stage in late 2008, right at the time when the US financial system was at risk of imploding and perhaps taking down the entire global financial system down with it. So trust in governments, in central banks, in traditional financial institutions, such as commercial banks, was at a very low ebb. So what Bitcoin promised was to serve as a pseudonymous medium of exchange, that is one, where you could conduct transactions using just your digital rather than real identities, and to be able to do so without relying on central bank money or a trusted intermediary, such as a credit card company or a commercial bank. So in that sense, a decentralized cryptocurrency such as Bitcoin really does something remarkable in terms of replacing the importance of a trusted intermediary in transactions with essentially community-based trust.
Right. That's interesting that it's trustless, but it does require trust in the community. Or is that a fair way to say that? We have to trust that the system itself works, that there aren't bad actors, that the fail safes that have built into the various protocols are actually going to work under stress and all that, correct?
Yeah, ultimately, some degree of trust is necessary, especially when you think about it. You know, if you and I, Jeff, were conducting transactions using just our digital identity, so I didn't even know who exactly was behind the digital Jeff, that would certainly be a little unnerving. But what Bitcoin managed to do was figure out an incredibly ingenious scheme, or the creators of Bitcoin figured out this ingenious scheme, whereby essentially you could use a form of what I think of as radical transparency. That is to say, every transaction ever conducted directly using Bitcoin, the transaction amounts, the digital identities of the transacting parties are all posted out there on public digital ledgers that are maintained on multiple computers. And it is this transparency at one level that provides both the security and resiliency of the network. So once transactions are validated on this network, and that is through a process by which all the computers on the network come to a consensus that certain transactions are valid. Once those transactions are validated, they are added in blocks to the existing blocks of transactions, which is where the term blockchain comes from. And it is this blockchain itself and the fact that it is transparent that prevents it from being tampered with by malevolent actors or by being corrupted in some form.
Correct. I was just looking at my phone, not checking my emails and stuff, but I was trying to get, my portion of, an account that I have up here where I just did a transaction with my partner. You can see it all right here. I know it's not very visible here, but it's remarkable how transparent this is. I sent him one Ether. It's a fake Ether. You can do this on what's called a test net, that it's not real, but it looks real. It shows up, like you say, it organizes into blocks. The blocks are validated, and it settled in about 15 seconds, and it was done. Compared to if I were to buy a stock or something like that, it certainly wouldn't be public, whereas this is out there. It's really quite remarkable, I think. So let's also talk a little bit more. Bitcoin, as you mentioned, is certainly the best known cryptocurrency, but there are a lot of other cryptocurrencies. There are tokens on the blockchain, and they have different functionality, utility tokens, etc. Over the years, these extra functions have been added. Could you tell us a little bit, maybe starting with the primary differences between Bitcoin and, say, Ether, and how those different types of what the different types of tokens do?
So Bitcoin has proven to be hopelessly inefficient at what it was supposed to do, which is serve as a pseudonymous medium of exchange. It turns out it's not very strong in terms of the anonymity it provides to users. It has very unstable value, which makes it an unreliable medium of exchange. Transactions on the Bitcoin network take a long time to be processed, on average about 10 minutes. For a block of transactions to be validated on the Bitcoin blockchain, it can handle only about 5 to 6 transactions per second. But what Bitcoin has done is set off a revolution where new cryptocurrencies have come up that try to make up for Bitcoin's flaws. The second most important cryptocurrency by market capitalization, as you mentioned, is Ether, which functions on the Ethereum blockchain. Now, Ether hasn't quite moved to a different consensus protocol yet, but it is in the process of doing so. When it does move, it is going to become a much more efficient cryptocurrency in terms of being able to handle a much larger volume of transactions, and where the processing time will fall substantially. And more importantly, the Ethereum blockchain turns out to have a great deal more functionality in terms of smart contracting and a variety of other features that are going to be the building blocks for this new movement in terms of decentralized finance. But it's not just Ether. There are other cryptocurrencies that try to provide stronger anonymity than Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies such as Monero and Zcash, or as my British training would have me have it, Zcash. These provide stronger anonymity, but with the cost in terms of being more cumbersome to use. And then, of course, there are stable coins Stable coins solve one of the fundamental problems with Bitcoin, that is its unstable value. But ironically enough, stable coins get their stable value because they are backed up by stores of fiat currencies. And the irony, of course, is that the whole point of Bitcoin was to get away from official currencies, and stable coins go right back to that. But what stable coins attempt to do is provide more efficient ways of conducting transactions. That is, they serve as more efficient means of payment, both within and across countries. So the Bitcoin revolution has resulted in a plethora of cryptocurrencies with different functionalities, as you pointed out, Jeff.
Right. And so we could have security tokens that represent ownership shares in certain assets. You could have utility tokens like that do things. You could have governance tokens that maybe implement the governance of an actual token, of a smart contract. These are the sort of like the spectrum, that you're talking about. And yeah, the reason why I did the fake Ether transaction, as you alluded to, the transaction costs are still very high. If I were to send Ether to somebody, it is pretty expensive still. And so, as you mentioned, there's a great rush to correct that. And it seems quite likely that if it does get cheaper, that will be a real spur to the adoption. A lot of your book is about kind of policy issues. It is about the future of money overall. It's not just crypto. In the modern world, central banks basically run the show on currency. Nearly everywhere they have a monopoly on the issuance of central bank money, kind of by definition. I did want to ask, in the 1970s, the economist Friedrich Hayek wrote an essay called The Denationalization of Money, in which he advocated competition among different currencies issued by private actors. I think he mentioned banks specifically. That was the assumption because banks, that's where the money is. But his basic point was that private banks should be able to issue fiat money. These are not commodity-based monies, which others have advocated, and that the competition with government fiat money would reduce the risk of hyperinflations, which he argued we see time and time in the past. So do you think that crypto could become a form of this private fiat money and operate side by side with the money that we know currently, and that it really does adopt some aspects or functions of money, dollar bills, bank deposits that we use right now?
That is an intriguing question, Jeff. And going back through monetary history, money itself was an innovation. And then the emergence of unbacked fiat currency, which came about in the time of Kublai Khan in China in the 13th century, that was a remarkable innovation. But of course, it created the temptation to print money recklessly to finance war expenditures and other government expenditures. So over the centuries, we've seen competition between backed or unbacked private money, often issued by commercial merchants or financial institutions, competing with official money, often issued by governments. The creation of central banks, which took place roughly over the last 200 years and at different times in different countries, decisively settled that competition in favor of central bank money. But now we are in a new era of competition between private and official currencies. And as an economist, certainly one might think competition is a good thing, so long as the competition has certain guardrails and that it doesn't create financial instability of its own. Now, I think we are at a moment where this question has become pressing, but it's not obvious to me that we are entering a true new era of competition. What we are beginning to see, I think, is the bifurcation of the roles of money. Now, money has traditionally fulfilled a number of roles, including serving as a unit of account, a medium of exchange, a store of value, but all these functions have been bundled together. We are now seeing stable coins and potentially other sort of electronic payment systems serve well as mediums of exchange. But the question is whether they can really replace central bank money as stores of value. My betting is that the answer is no. Certainly, we've seen decentralized cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin essentially become pure speculative financial assets. But I don't think they're going to serve as durable long-term sources of value, especially if they don't have any intrinsic value, and their value seems to largely come from scarcity, which in turn seems to give some investors faith that they will maintain their value. So we might see more competition, but also a specialization of the functions of money as we go along.
That's interesting. And so on, let's say, the securitization side, which has begun to get some momentum, it would be possible, I guess this is a yes or no question or a leading question, that a cryptocurrency, a blockchain-based security token could kind of become the standard for real estate, for commodities. People have talked about this. I believe that one bank has issued a token that is basically tokenized gold. That's something, though, that it really, I mean, it is connected to a physical asset. So that is something that, like you say, I mean, it seems to be that the crypto kind of chipping away at the monopoly of money on different functions. And as you say, it's kind of unbundling. Is that, I mean, that seems to be the way that you think things could go, at least up to a certain point.
That's right. Now, if you think about what money does, what it does is get around two issues of coordination. One is spatial and the other is intertemporal. If you think about converting savings into productive investments, or if you think about matching needs of different buyers and sellers across space, money turns out to be a very efficient way of doing that. If you're conducting transactions on blockchains where the spatial constraints in particular fall away, it's not obvious you even need a medium of exchange the way you might think about it right now. So in other words, if you had a financial asset that was tokenized, I had a financial asset that was tokenized, we might not even need the traditional medium of exchange to be able to conduct these transactions. And one could even think about the Uberization of money in the future. I mean, Uber solves a spatial coordination problem more or less effectively. If you think about, you know, financial intermediation, especially that done by commercial banks, a lot of this is getting around intertemporal coordination problems. So perhaps we might see, and this is something I allude to in my book, the Uberization of money in some form, whereby, again, one can undertake the spatial coordination as well as intertemporal coordination without using money in any of its traditional forms.
Right. And it's interesting that even central bankers who are the central bankers who have expressed skepticism about crypto generally, especially things like Bitcoin as being speculative, everybody kind of acknowledges that our payment system is creaky. It's probably outdated in terms of technology. If you try to do international transfers, oh my, I mean, you can get in big trouble. I mean, the irony is it does require trust and banks and stuff, but if you have a problem to kind of unfold that, if you've ever been involved in one of these, even a business-to-business transaction, it's not a lot of fun. Let's talk a little bit about the central bank digital currencies, because there's a big debate right now. I think the Fed released its a paper last week. The Fed didn't really come down on one side or the other. It was sort of pluses and minuses. It seemed to me that they're saying to the government, tell us what to do. What are the pluses and minuses of a Fed or other central bank digital currency? And what do you think is the real motivation driving the voices that want the Fed to do a digital dollar?
So I think one of the interesting legacies of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is, lighting a fire under central banks to start thinking about issuing digital versions of their own official currencies. And there is a variety of motivations at play here. In many developing countries, including the Bahamas, which has issued the world's first nationwide CBDC, and likewise in Nigeria, the second nationwide CBDC, the objective is to increase financial inclusion, give the masses easy access to a low-cost digital payment system, and perhaps to use it as a portal for basic banking products and services. In a country like Sweden, where the private sector is doing a great job of providing digital payments to the population, the Riksbank has undertaken the e-krona project, essentially viewing it as a backstop to a private payments infrastructure. A private payments infrastructure might work very well in good times, but is subject to technological vulnerabilities, perhaps issues of confidence. So one can think about the e-krona as essentially being a backstop. China, of course, is sui generis in this as in much else. In China, Alipay and WeChat Pay have blanketed the country with low-cost digital payments that every consumer, business, and every nook and cranny of the country has access to. But these two payment giants have come to dominate the payment space. They are limiting competition, perhaps limiting innovation. And more importantly, the Chinese government, as we've seen, is very concerned about the troves of data that these payment platforms are gathering, using for commercial purposes, and have until recently not been willing to share with the government. So there are these multiple motivations at play. And in the context of the US, I think a broader set of issues comes into play. Certainly a CBDC would bring a lot of economic activity out of the shadows, make it harder to use central bank money for illicit transactions, either domestic or cross-border, which is all good. If you think about each of us having a central bank digital currency wallet, that would certainly help undertake monetary policy in perilous times. And God knows we've lived through very perilous times in the last decade and a half. So helicopter drops of money, that is lump sum transfers to a large part of the population, negative nominal policy interest rates, all become feasible. Now, these are all desperate tools for desperate times, but even in normal times with CBDC, might have an advantage. You know, even in the US, about 5% of households are unbanked or underbanked. But there are real concerns. One is disintermediation of the banking system if people prefer to keep deposits with the central bank rather than commercial banks, limiting private sector payments innovation, and of course, the loss of privacy. Now, on all of these issues, I think technology is showing us ways to mitigate, if not eliminate, the risks. So one can think about a CBDC as providing a payment infrastructure, but the front end in terms of payment services is left to commercial banks and other payment providers, so you don't block private payments innovation. The Bahamas has shown you can simply put a cap on the amount of money that can be held in a CBDC digital wallet, so you don't have wholesale intermediation. Privacy is something we might be able to arrive at some sort of a compromise on, but the reality is that anything digital ultimately is going to leave a trace. So this is why I think the Fed, in its wisdom, has decided that it's better not to rush into this. It's good to see what sort of lessons can be learned from other countries. And ultimately, given the broader implications, this is not just a matter that can be settled on a technocratic or economic basis. It has to be a societal consideration. So I think the Fed is wise in looking for broad public and political support before it moves forward.
Right. Well, I mean, since you mentioned it, I mean, let's just talk about the regulatory environment a little bit. I think that the White House is supposed to be putting forward, it's been described either a paper, some of the crypto media, which is very active and really, well, I guess active is the right way to put it, say that there will be an executive order, which seems a little bit premature. What would you, the SEC has embarked upon a lot of, has made proposals, threats, if you will. Is there a consistent policy from the government? What would you expect this White House, let's say a position paper to come out with?
I think every government, every regulatory agency is very concerned, but these are new technologies and the traditional modes of regulation do not work very well. You know, we're used to regulating institutions. And if you think about decentralized finance, that takes place on decentralized blockchains. The governance structure is also decentralized. So who to regulate and how best to regulate are open questions. Countries like China have taken a very extreme approach, essentially banning any sort of cryptocurrency-related activity altogether. But I think enlightened regulators in other countries recognize that there are innovations that could have benefits for consumers and businesses in terms of providing new products and services, in terms of providing broader access and so on. So you don't want to limit that innovation completely. But the key question is how one can set guardrails around these innovations so that you don't have financial stability risks either within this ecosystem or risks that spill over into the traditional financial system. Second, how one thinks about issues like investor protection. One might say if people want to invest in crypto assets with their eyes wide open, what role does the government have? But I think there are questions about whether people fully understand the risks of products that are on offer and whether the government should in fact be making sure that at least the risks made very clear. But this is going to be very challenging because, first of all, there are no clear central points of authority given the decentralized governance structures here, where the government can go in very easily with the regulations. This is a very fast moving arena. So trying to set up regulations for specific types of products and services may not work very well. Third, you know, Bitcoin knows no borders, and that's true of most crypto assets and blockchain-based finance. So you need regulatory coordination across countries. So there is a risk here. Now, at the same time, the cryptocurrency industry, I think, recognizes there are some benefits to be had from at least some degree of regulation, because it does provide a veneer of legitimacy, provides more confidence for consumers and businesses in dealing in this space. But of course, the moment they see the specifics of regulation, there are complaints that it is too intrusive. So both from the industry side and from the government side, I think this is a tough balancing act, and we are nowhere near getting to that right point yet.
Yeah, I mean, I often see, you know, people say, please regulate us, set the guardrails, but don't regulate me or don't regulate what we're doing. So yeah, I think that there's going to be a lot of push and pull there. You did mention risks. I mean, how vulnerable do you think the crypto ecosystem is to design flaws, bugs, malicious attacks, you know, from some of the voting systems, you know, that are embedded? You know, we still, a lot of this is autonomous, but people still have to decide on the overall direction. And, you know, there are cases in which this could happen. I mean, do you think, and with money, you do have risks, you could get robbed, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't really have to think too much about the core technology of it. Is this going to be a real barrier to widespread adoption, that it could just all fall apart? It's just vulnerable? Or do you think that the system is pretty resilient?
So the wonderful aspects of decentralized finance, of which blockchain is an important manifestation, of course, is that it has, first of all, decentralized architecture. So you have public digital ledgers being maintained on multiple computers at the same time. You do have a decentralized trust, so you don't have to place trust in a particular institution or a group that could collude against the interests of the broader community. And you have decentralized governance, which goes in the same direction. All of these are wonderful features, and at one level, they do create some degree of resilience and security. But I think the notion that technology and decentralization will solve all problems might prove to be a chimera as well. There are certainly technological vulnerabilities. Now, the Bitcoin blockchain has not been hacked, but many exchanges on which Bitcoin has been traded have been hacked. And there might be deeper technological vulnerabilities that we might eventually be exposed to. We spoke about smart contracts. Now, many of these blockchains are, you know, self-contained ecosystems, but they do need to communicate with the outside world, maybe other blockchains, maybe the real world in terms of commodity exchanges and so on. If you think about securities being traded on the blockchain, and those conduits called price oracles, or oracles more broadly, might be subject to a variety of technical and conceptual flaws. And even decentralized governance might be a problem. If, for instance, you find that there are certain flaws in the way a particular protocol operates, you can tell the community to fix it. And certainly, given that this is open source code, and given that the community by and large seems responsible, the problems might get fixed, but you could get malevolent actors in the interim taking advantage of these flaws, which would undermine the trust that is really important as a bulwark of the system. So I don't think this system, while it does look quite resilient and secure overall, can be trusted to manage itself. And the risks in particular of risks migrating to the traditional financial system are pretty important ones that regulators cannot afford to ignore.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So I'm going to invite you to be a market strategist for a second, which is probably something you don't want to do, but I'm going to have to ask anyway, because you know, most of the period when Bitcoin and other crypto grew up has been a period of very easy money. And even though a lot of the ethos at the beginning was sort of against fiat money against central banks controlling this because it would be inflationary, it sort of grew in line with an easy money era, which now may be ending. The Fed has told us this week that rates will be going up soon, could be going up a bit more than we had thought. We don't really know. So let's assume that there's going to be a tightening cycle, and it's not just the Fed, it's going to be fairly global. You know, in that world, in an inflationary world, Bitcoin should do pretty well against that. But what do you think if rates go up? I mean, will that really fundamentally diminish the importance or the attraction of these cryptocurrencies? Or is the value largely independent of what the Fed does?
One thing I can say with great confidence is that there is a great deal of price volatility ahead in cryptocurrencies. And the reason for my saying that is that there is no clear anchor to the value of a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, a decentralized cryptocurrency, I mean. I argued earlier that Bitcoin is not serving well as a medium of exchange, so it does not have any clear intrinsic value. Most investors seem to believe that because it is scarce, ultimately, there are going to be only 21 million Bitcoins, of which about 19 million have been created so far. That the notion is that it has to preserve its value relative to something like the US dollar, which can be printed essentially in infinite quantities by the Fed. But I don't think scarcity by itself is a fundamental source of value. And what Bitcoin seems to have become is largely a pure speculative asset. And like any other asset, its value is going to be determined by what happens to the prices of less risky assets, in this case, US treasuries, and what happens with the interest rates. So certainly, the notion that Bitcoin could serve as a good inflation hedge doesn't seem to be bearing out in the data, at least so far. And if the Fed does continue with interest rate hikes, and if the yield curve does shift up with rising inflationary expectations, it's hard to see Bitcoin not experiencing substantial volatility. Notice I'm not taking a clear position whether it goes up or down, but we're going to see a lot more volatility.
Okay, that's fair. Fair enough. As I mentioned at the beginning, I would like to ask if you had any thoughts about what's going on in China right now. The deleveraging process, which kind of was really all over the media, kind of comes and goes. I mean, where do you think the Chinese economy is right now? Do you think that there's something that most Western perceptions is getting wrong? I guess that's my main question.
So I had an op-ed in the FT just a few days ago where I argued that the Chinese government has the right intentions in many ways. It is eager to fix many problems, some of which are of its own making, but it is approaching them in a slightly schizophrenic way. And that schizophrenia is essentially related to how intrusive the role the state plays in the economy. So China wants to continue with deleveraging, while at the same time, it continues to rely on the industrial sector, especially large state-owned enterprises, to continue generating credit. It's very eager for the private sector to generate wealth, to create innovation, but at the same time, it doesn't want tech companies in particular, but the private sector more broadly to become too influential in the economy. The government wants market discipline to work, but is not necessarily working on building the institutional framework, such as improvements in corporate governance, corporate transparency, auditing and accounting procedures necessary for the markets to work very well. So overall, I'm optimistic that the Chinese economy is moving ever so gradually in the right direction, but this schizophrenia is going to mean a lot more stumbles and accidents. But it is interesting that the government seems to have taken the view that while there is going to be a set of problems that lead to growth being somewhat lower, they are willing to accept somewhat lower growth in return for preventing imbalances, especially financial sector imbalances, from building up to the extent that they had in the past. But they are sitting on top of a very large problem already, so the room for maneuver is quite limited. But we've been saying this about China for a couple of decades right now, and if there's anybody who can pull off this difficult balancing act, perhaps it's the Chinese. But there is a lot of volatility still ahead.
Yeah, and we talk about the lost decades of whatever, Japanese growth, US growth, but there's also a couple lost decades of Economist predictions of China blowing up. That's very true. Anyway, on my copy, I just looked at my copy. I had sort of put it on page 228, so I've got about halfway through. Everybody, it's a really great book. It's just chock full of insights and really clear explanations of everything that's going on, not only with blockchain, but money and finance overall. Ishwar, thanks for being with us.
That was a real fun conversation, Jeff. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The content is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any such information or other material as legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. Nothing contained in this material constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer by Deep Macro Incorporated or any third-party service provider to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in this or in any other jurisdiction in which such solicitation or offer would be unlawful under the securities laws of such jurisdiction. All content is information of a general nature and does not address the circumstances of any particular individual or entity. None of the information constitutes professional and or financial advice, nor does any of the information constitute a comprehensive or complete statement of the matters discussed or the law relating thereto. There are risks associated with investing. Loss of principal is possible. Some high-risk investments may use leverage, which will accentuate gains and losses of securities or a firm's past investment performance. Is not a guarantee or predictor of future investment performance.